Sovereign Fury, from Genesis chapter 37, verses 1 through 28. This message by Pastor Rod Harris was delivered at Trinity Baptist Church on Wednesday evening, September the 29th, 2010.
A certain amount of it's just to be expected. I mean, it's the kind of thing that happens. Brothers don't always get along. Brothers argue, sometimes they fight. Sometimes they get jealous of each other. Sometimes they get furious with each other. And sibling rivalry, I can't even say it. Sibling rivalry, there we go, is a natural thing, but this is way out of bounds. This is off the chart as far as that's concerned. I mean, they sold their brother to some traveling salesman. That's an outrageous thing. How in the world could they do that? Why would they do that? It's an extraordinary story when we look at the life of Joseph. We know that he was his father's favorite. We know that his brothers didn't like him. We know the whole story and how he ends up in Egypt and the famine and all of that. He's a towering figure in the Old Testament. In fact, his story runs from Genesis chapter 37 through chapter 50. So 14 chapters are spent on his life. That's equal to the amount of time spent on Abraham. So that tells us that he's an important figure. He's one of the looming figures of the Old Testament. He was a man of unusual character. I don't know if you're aware of this, but when you look at the scriptural record, there's nothing negative said about him in the Old or New Testament. Not a negative word. Now, he was a man of flesh and bone. He was a frail child of dust along with the rest of us. He was not a perfect man, but he was a good and righteous man, a man of whom the favor of God rested. His life story reads like an adventure novel. He's born the favorite child of a great patriarch. He was set for a life of ease and comfort, and then he gets sold into slavery. He gets taken to a foreign land. He gets imprisoned falsely. He somehow, through the providential working of God, rises to power, and you know the story. Our text tonight is found in Genesis chapter 37, and we're going to look at verse 1 down through verse 28. Genesis 37, beginning in verse 1. Jacob lived in the land of his father, sojourning in the land of Canaan. These are the generations of Jacob. Joseph, being 17 years old, was pasturing the flock with his brothers. He was a boy with the sons of Bilhah and Zilpah, his father's wives. And Joseph brought a bad report of them to their father. Now Israel loved Joseph more than any of the other sons, because he was the son of his old age, and he made him a robe of many colors. But when his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, they hated him and could not speak peacefully to him. Now Joseph had a dream, and when he told it to his brothers, they hated him even more. He said to them, "Hear this dream that I've had. Behold, we were binding sheaves in the field, and behold, my sheaf rose and stood upright, and behold, your sheaves gathered around it and bowed down to my sheaf." His brother said to him, "Are you indeed to reign over us, or are you indeed to rule over us?" So they hated him even more for his dreams and for his words. Then he dreamed another dream, and he told it to his brothers and said, "Behold, I have dreamed another dream. Behold, the sun and the moon and 11 stars were bowing down to me." But when he told it to his father and to his brothers, his father rebuked him and said to him, "What is this dream that you have dreamed? Shall I and your mother and your brothers indeed come to bow ourselves down to the ground before you?" And his brothers were jealous of him, but his father kept the saying in mind. Now his brothers went to pasture their father's flocks near Shechem. And Israel said to Joseph, "Are not your brothers pasturing the flocks at Shechem? Come, I will send you to them." He said to him, "Here am I." So he said to him, "Go now and see if all is well with your brothers and with the flock, and bring word to me." So he sent him from the valley of Hebron, and he came to Shechem. And a man found him wandering in the fields. And the man asked him, "What are you seeking?" "I'm seeking my brothers," he said. "Tell me, please, where they are pasturing the flock." And the man said, "They've gone away. For I heard them say, 'Let us go to Dothan.'" So Joseph went after his brothers and found them in Dothan. They saw him from afar. And before he came near to them, they conspired against him to kill him. They said to one another, "Here comes this dreamer. Come now, let us kill him and throw him into one of the pits. Then we will say that a fierce animal has devoured him, and we will see what will become of his dreams." But when Reuben heard it, he rescued him out of their hands, saying, "Let us not take his life." And Reuben said to them, "Shed no blood. Cast him into this pit here in the wilderness, but do not lay a hand on him, that he might rescue him out of their hands and restore him to his father." So when Joseph came to his brothers, they stripped him of his robe, the robe of many colors that he wore, and they took him and cast him into a pit. The pit was empty. There was no water in it. Then they sat down to eat, and looking up, they saw a caravan of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead with their camels bearing gum, balm, and myrrh, on their way to carry it down to Egypt. Judah said to his brothers, "What profit is it if we kill our brother and conceal his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, and let not our hand be upon him, for he is our brother, our own flesh." And his brothers listened to him. Then Midianite traders passed by, and they drew Joseph up and lifted him out of the pit and sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver. They took Joseph to Egypt. And you thought your family had problems. This is one mixed up family. This is the family that put D in dysfunctional. Now see, we like to think that all of this, all the isms have occurred in our generation. We like to think that, well, it's the stress of modern life that's just destroyed the family. But read the story. Go back and look at this family and all the things that were going on. I mean, they were dysfunctional before dysfunctional was being cool. They had a lot of problems. Think about it for just a minute. Just think about the story of Jacob and his family. Jacob married two women, and they were sisters. He took two additional women as concubines, and he had children by all of them. Do you think there was any stress in that home? Think there were any problems that ever came up because of that? Think there was any rivalry in that home? Do you think there was any problems at all in relationships? Jealousy, rivalry, and envy abounded in their home. Add to that the fact that mom and dad both had their favorites, and they made it real clear to everyone who their favorite was. And they tried to manipulate and maneuver things on behalf of their favorites. Lying, scheming, and manipulating was a way of life within this family. We could go back further than that. We don't have to start with Jacob and his family. We can go back to Adam and Eve if you want. Cain killed his brother because he was jealous. So it seems that since the fall, that's where we've been. Dysfunctional families didn't start in the 90s. It's been around from the beginning. There are dysfunctional families because we're dysfunctional, because of sin, because we are marred by corruption. In fact, I think maybe it's a bit of a redundancy to say dysfunctional family. Maybe all we need to do is say family, and the implication of that is dysfunction. There are problems in family relationships, but this family seems to take it to a whole new level. You know the story. You're very familiar with it. You've been in church any length of time at all. You're familiar with the story, and you've heard it again and again and again, and you can tell it, and you know all about his coat of many colors and all of that, and you know about his brothers got jealous, and we just read the text. But there's more to it than just the fact that he was the favorite. There's more to it than just the fact his father loved him more than he loved the brothers. There is another theme underlying it, and I think it's important for us to recognize it, because the story of Joseph is a story of the sovereignty of God. That's what's really driving the whole engine. That's what's really going on, and that's what really they are reacting to. Three things I want to point out to you. First of all, in verse 1 down through verse 11, note that the sovereignty of God stirs great emotion within the hearts of rebellious men. Rebellious men don't like God's sovereignty. And that really is what they're reacting to in this passage. Now, it's interesting that we have this reference to Jacob. Jacob lived in the land of his father, sojourning in the land of Canaan. Verse 2, these are the generations of Jacob. Joseph being 17 years old. It's a literary device that Moses is using. This is the generation of that signals we're changing. It signals we're moving on to another story. It's used 11 times throughout the book of Genesis. It's marking a turning of the page. It's marking a new chapter. So now we're moving into the story of Joseph. And Joseph's going to come to the forefront. And he's going to be the focus through the rest of the book. Now, it's also interesting because when you look in chapter 36, you find reference to all these chiefs and kings, and there's this long listing of descendants from Esau. But when we come to Jacob, the only one mentioned is Joseph, because he becomes the focus. Because we're narrowing the story to show the godly line. We're narrowing the story to show the major player in the great drama that's moving. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph. So it's the author signaling to us that this is the new character we're going to focus on. And so now we begin to look at Joseph. Now read verse 2 again. Look at the last part of the verse. Joseph, being 17 years old, was pasturing the flock with his brothers. He was a boy with the sons of Bilhah and Zilpah, his father's wives, and Joseph brought a bad report of them to their father. So when you see verse 2, you say, well, no wonder they didn't like the kid. No wonder there were problems. He's a snitch. He's 17 years old. He's still a kid. He's out with his brothers, and he gives a report to his father. So you read that, and you say, well, maybe there's a reason why they didn't like him. Maybe there's something about his character that he's not all that likable, but there's really something else going on. Look, continuing on into verse 3. Now, Israel loved Joseph more than any of his sons because he was the son of his old age, and he made him a robe of many colors. The scriptures are brutally honest, and the heroes of the scripture are not always presented as just wonderful, glorious people. They're presented as they really were. Men of flesh and bone, men who were fallen, men who were corrupt, and we're told that his father loved one of his children more than all the others. And it's clear from the way it's stated, and it was obvious to anybody who was paying any attention at all. It wasn't a matter that in his heart he felt a special way toward Joseph. He felt it, and he expressed it, and he made it known. Now, there is understanding of why he might have a unique place in his heart for Joseph. We're told that Joseph was the son of his old age, so he's quite a bit younger than the others. Add to that he is Rachel's child. Rachel was the love of Jacob's life. Remember, he worked 14 years for her. And you remember what the scripture said about those 14 years? It says it went by like nothing because he so loved Rachel. There is some understanding as to why he would have been so favored. Also, it's clear that Joseph was different from his brothers. He was a young boy when they came back and Jacob returned to Canaan. Probably around 13 by the time his father showed him the spot where God had given him that great vision of a ladder or a stairway to heaven. And it no doubt made a profound impression upon the young boy as he recounted his experience with God. He was a young boy when he saw his father limp across the Jabbok and tell them of the fact that he had wrestled with God all night. So there is a unique bond. There is a unique relationship. Joseph's tender heart had been touched by God, And it's going to become evident God was molding him for a purpose. The hand of God was upon him. And you're not going to understand the story of Joseph, and you're not going to really understand the reaction of the brothers unless you nail it down, underscore it, circle it. The hand of God was upon Joseph. The sovereignty of God had made a choice. And they're reacting to God's choice. Now, we're told something else. In Genesis 35, you might remember, Reuben was Jacob's firstborn, but he slept with his father's concubine. And in so doing, disgraced himself, disgraced his father, and he lost the birthright. He was no longer entitled to the birthright because of his wickedness. So now it was left to the father to give it to whomever he chose. And it certainly appears that he chose to give it to his favorite. How do we know that? He gave him this coat of many colors. Now, Joseph's coat of many colors has caused a lot of problem for biblical scholars, because they really don't know for sure what the Hebrew means. In fact, coat of many colors is not even taken from the Hebrew. It's taken from the Greek translation, the Septuagint. The Hebrew says he gave him a coat with long sleeves. A long coat with long sleeves. Now, you and I read that and we say, what's that all about? But then you understand, as you look into it, that a working man did not have long sleeves. His cloak did not have long sleeves, had short sleeves, and it didn't go down to his ankles. It was shorter because you don't want to wear this long robe when you've got work to do. So to have a long coat with long sleeves implies you're a supervisor. You're not working. So this coat was a sign that he was favored. The coat was a sign that he's been given the birthright, that he's the child of choice. And that's what they are reacting to. This snot-nosed kid being put over us. This would also explain why he would be reporting to his fathers about his brothers. It's not just that he was a tattletale. He had some responsibility. He was put in authority. And so he's simply reporting to his father as he was required to do. There's a reference in John chapter 4 and verse 5 about that plot of land where Jacob's well is. It's the only piece of property that Jacob owned. And John 4 and verse 5 says that's the land that Jacob gave to Joseph. So there's all these indicators that not only was he the favorite, but he's the one of blessing. He's the one favored with the rights of the firstborn and so forth. Joseph had been sovereignly chosen. And look at their reaction, verse 4. But when his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, they hated him and could not speak peacefully to him. They didn't have a kind word for their brother. They couldn't stand their brother. And the reason was the hand of God was upon him. The reason was God favored him. The reason was God chose to bless him. And they weren't happy about that. The choice is then confirmed in two visions in verse 5 down through verse 11. The sheaves, and then the moon and the sun and the stars bowing. Now, you can question his wisdom in telling his brothers, but you can't question his sincerity. He's excited. Why is he excited? He's excited because God's up to something. He's excited because God's favor. And he's telling them this wonderful thing that God is revealing to him. It's marvelous. It's glorious. He's still trying to put all the pieces together and understand the great meaning of all of it. But what he did know was God is telling him something. God is favoring him. And he thought everybody would be excited about that. But when he told them, they weren't excited about it at all. In fact, we're told they hated him all the more because of his dreams. Specifically, they did not like the notion that they were to bow down, but that was the revealed will of God. And they are reacting in anger against God's revelation. Now, it is interesting that on the other vision, when he told his father had somewhat the same reaction. I mean, what would you do as a father if your child came into you, he's 17 years old, and he said, "Dad, it's great. God showed me you and Mom and all my brothers are going to bow down to me." You know, if I had said that to my dad, I would have heard that sound, that very familiar sound. It's just kind of a whoosh as the belt is being pulled through the belt loops. And he'd say, "I'll teach you about bowing down." I mean, that's the reaction. You've got to be kidding me. But Jacob backed off, and he kept that in mind. In other words, yeah, God's up to something, and I don't want to argue too much with this. But his brothers hated and despised him, and they hated him, don't miss it, because of his dreams. The sovereignty of God stirs rebellion in the heart of the rebellious. When ungodly people are confronted with the notion of the sovereignty of God, that God is in control, they don't like it. And they react to it in anger. And that's what's happening in this story. Second, beginning at verse 12, down through verse 28. Hatred of God's sovereignty drives vain attempts to derail God's sovereign rule. God gave Joseph this vision, two of them. No question about it. Your brothers will bow down. In fact, your father will bow down to you. You're going to be in a position of authority. You're going to be a ruler. You're going to be someone of prominence and importance. They didn't like the message. They were determined that's not going to happen. And so they determined that they would take care of it themselves. The brothers are out tending their sheep. Their father's concerned about them, and so he sends Joseph to go check on him. He takes about a 4 or 5 day journey. And by the time he gets there, he goes where they were, and they're not there. And he gets word, well, they moved on down to Dothan, so he made the trip down there. And then look at their reaction beginning in verse 18. They saw him from afar, and before he came near to them, they conspired against him to kill him. And they said to one another, "Here comes this dreamer." And you got to know that was his nickname as far as they were concerned, the dreamer. Here comes this dreamer. Here comes this troublemaker. Here comes that snot-nosed little brother of ours. Come now, let us kill him and throw him into one of the pits. Then we'll say some fierce animal did it. They despised him. They despised what he stood for. They said, "We don't agree with the vision. And we're going to ensure that vision never comes to pass." And so they act. Envy is a terrible thing. Donald Gray Barnhouse says, "When a man is covetous and envious, he is saying to God, 'I am not satisfied. You have not given me what I want.' Such a man would dethrone God and redeal the events and possessions of life so that little he would be exalted." Covetousness and envy, whether we would ever use these words or not, is saying, "God, I'm not satisfied. You haven't treated me right. You haven't given me what I want, and I'm not happy about it." And so they hatch their little plan. You can hear the venom in their words when they say, "We'll see what comes of his dreams now. Let's kill him. Let's throw his worthless, lifeless body in a pit and then see what happens with his dreams." Verse 21 and 22, his brother Reuben steps up and seeks to redeem himself. Remember, he's already got in trouble. He lost the birthright. Now they're talking about killing. Maybe, I don't know that Reuben, just out of the goodness of his heart, thought, no, we don't want to do this. I think probably Reuben was saying, I might be able to get back in if I save him and take him back home to Dad and explain to him how I stepped in and rescued. So he said, let's not do that. Let's just throw him in a pit. And so they do. And as they're discussing it, as they're thinking about it, another brother, Judah, says, wait, here comes some traveling salesman. Let's not kill him. Let's just sell him. Brotherly love at its best. It would be wrong to kill our brother, so let's sell him. There's no real profit in it for us if we don't do it that way. We don't want to have something like his blood on our hands. We want to be innocent in all of this, so let's just sell him. Let's just get what we can out of him and let him be taken down to Egypt as a slave. And so that's their decision, and their mission is accomplished in verse 28. What they do not understand, and what rebellious men never understand, is that their arms are too short to box with God. What they did not understand, what rebellious people do not understand, what you and I often fail to recognize, is that the will of God is going to be accomplished. And no amount of our scheming and plotting and planning is going to change that. We can react all we want against the sovereign rule of God, but at the end of the day, God is still sovereign. And his will marches on. Brings to the last thing I want to mention to you, just kind of as a way of summing up. The faithful servant of the Lord willingly yields to the sovereign activity of God. See, the rebellious are always fighting it. They're always reacting in anger to it. But the faithful yield. You know the rest of the story. How the events and the circumstances all seem to work perfectly together, so that even though there were bumps along the way and problems along the way, eventually he came to power and exactly what God said would happen, happened. His brothers all bowed before him. His father bowed before him. He came to prominence in the most powerful nation on earth. What they were sure they had derailed, they actually put on track. So that's important to recognize, because that is always the case. So there's no doubt that Satan, the enemy of our souls, rejoiced at the murder of the Christ, because he finally accomplished it. He finally overcame. No, he didn't overcome anything. He accomplished what God determined would be done. Yielding to the sovereign activity of God. See, you and I are not aware of where things are heading. Unless we've been given a vision like Joseph was given, unless we're told in some specific detail, we don't always know where things are going. We don't understand why things are happening. And if we do have an idea of where it is going or where it's supposed to go, certain things come along and happen, and we say, there's no way this fits in. There's no way this is a part of that. And often what seems to be inconsequential turns out to be a major part of the story. In 1969-1970, somewhere in that 2 years, my parents made a decision, and that is that they were going to leave Carbondale Baptist Church and move their membership to Trinity Baptist Church. And so our family came here. So that I was raised here, got to know people here, built relationships here, went on choir trips, all of that, had my Sunday school teachers and all of those who played a major role in my life. It was here that I felt the call to ministry, and several who prayed with me and for me and helped me work through that and made that public here. Went to OBU. I was going to go to OSU. Had my room assignment, my dorm mate all lined up. And in the summer, with the events that came about, I needed to go to OBU instead of OSU. Ended up there, met friends there that became lifelong friends. Went from there to seminary in Fort Worth. After finishing the seminary in Fort Worth, a friend of mine that I met at OBU and deepened our relationship in seminary was pastoring the First Baptist Church of Perkins. And he had to be gone one Sunday, and he asked me, would you go preach for me on Sunday? I said, oh, sure. Any opportunity I get, I'll take that. So Riadon and I drove to Perkins, just outside Stillwater, and preached. He, before he left town, called the director of missions and said, I've got a seminary student filling in if there's any churches looking for a pastor. And through an offhand comment, a pulpit committee showed up there. They later called and asked us to come and preach. We end up at Masham. 2 years later, another friend from OBU was leaving his church in Ponca City, and he told the committee they ought to call and talk to me. They called. I ended up following him in Ponca City. When I was in Ponca City, after about 3 years, I just happened to call Steve Bass and ask him to come do a revival for me. Steve and I had been friends at OBU, and in the conversation, as I'm asking him to come, he said, I'm just glad you called because I was going to call you. I said, for what? He said, I would like to recommend your name to Trinity to be their pastor. I said, well, that's a foolish idea. And he said, I know it is, but I want to do it anyway. And so he submitted it. And here we are. And all along the way, I had no idea what these things had in common and what these things would lead to. But you look back and say, those are important, significant markers of what God was doing in my life. You don't know where things are going. So that's why it's a dangerous thing when we buck up against the working of God in our lives. Difficult times come. God allowed that for a reason. Now, I may never know why. Don't believe the notion that someday you'll understand. You may never understand. Sometimes we say, well, yeah, I can't wait till I get to heaven because then I'm going to know why. You don't have any assurance of that. God's never promised you that. And you want to know what the real kicker is? By the time you get there and you're in the presence of the Lord God, you won't care. It won't matter anymore. But good, bad, or indifferent, the events of our lives are not random. They're not chance. It's the working of a sovereign, loving, providential God. And there's hope. There's encouragement. Now, that doesn't mean I like everything, because I don't. There are some things I don't like at all. And there are those times when I think, Lord, what in the world are you thinking? And there are those times that I try to give him advice. But God is at work. And the faithful servant yields to the providential working of God, rejoicing because God is about his business, which is for my good and for his glory.
You've been listening to a Plowman podcast. Find us on the web at theplowman.org. The Plowman features the preaching ministry of Rod Harris, pastor of Trinity Baptist Church in Tulsa, Oklahoma, located at the corner of 41st and Union. To learn more about the ministries at Trinity Baptist Church, visit us on the web at www.tbctulsa.org.